We're working with a new system this morning, so bear with me if we have a glitch or two, but we'll get it straightened out. I think we can go forward and backward here. Okay, we were in the middle of this exciting story about how the last king of the north established himself as king of the north and how he will come to his end. The Egyptians, we remember, controlled Palestine and the area up north, most of Lebanon, and were encroaching on Damascus. They recognized that the Ottomans were trying to come further south in 1517, so they pushed at the which the scripture said they will push at him towards the north, and so the Ottomans reacted and they killed the Sultan of Egypt, and so with the Egyptians after that, the Egyptians panicked, as they always do when they lose their leader or anything else happens. The Egyptians leading the rout, the Ottomans chased them all the way back to Cairo, where 6 months later the Ottomans were victorious, conquering Egypt completely. The phrase King of the South is never again used in this or any other prophecies. That entity had been eradicated from Jerusalem and Palestine and from history. The Ottoman troops had plainly overflowed and passed over Palestine, where historians tell us there was practically no fighting, merely pursuit of the Egyptians in wild, scattered commotion on their way to Egypt proper. Due to the Ottomans' positive and overshadowing presence in Egypt, the Libyans and the Ethiopians, which in the Hebrew is Cush, the Sudan, also came under the Ottomans' control, and verse 41 confirms this. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. This is Egypt and the others that we've mentioned. Now note this phrase, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab and the chief of the children of Ammon. Now this is what happened. The king of the north entered into the glorious land and overflowed it and passed over with little attention to it. There was nothing there. There were hardly any people. There was no vegetation. It was dry, arid, desolate. And Palestine was to him on that occasion a mere highway to Egypt, but unimportant in its own right. It was almost uninhabited, a desolate, poor wasteland, useless and unproductive. But many countries were overthrown. Egypt's possessions in the north, Syria and Palestine, as well as Egypt itself, were all overthrown and placed under tribute, which we shall soon see. Libya and Sudan, Ethiopia, were intimidated so that they too fell into line with the Ottomans and became her subjects. The most interesting portion of this verse tells of the escape of Edom, Moab, and most of the children of Ammon. Historians tell us that these three areas, east, south, and northeast of the Dead Sea, over in Jordan, were sparsely inhabited by Bedouins who were naturally anarchic and practically uncontrollable. The Ottomans never did exercise its complete hegemony over these specific areas during their occupation between 1517 and 1917 because it just wasn't worth the effort. Beyond these areas lay the trackless wastes of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, which was also worth almost nothing to them. So they ignored that. He shall stretch forth his hand. The next verse is, he shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. Well, we've seen how that happened. Stretching forth his hand means that he exercised hegemony over them by force, and he threatened their existence if they didn't pay tribute and comply with his wishes. The land of Egypt did not escape, for it was conquered and placed also under tribute to the port of Constantinople. Verse 43, but he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver and over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. What does this mean? His power over the treasures of gold and of silver and over all the precious things of Egypt is the prophet's way of saying that the Ottomans would now begin to extract from Egypt serially and progressively its precious treasures and its liquid capital. It at one time had considerable of this. This is what happens when a nation is placed under tribute. The threat is if they don't pay the tribute, then their overlords will return and obliterate them. Turkey of that day was strong and aggressive, and Egypt knew that it could exercise that intention. It's a pretty strong reason in the face of weakness to continue to pay any tribute which is demanded. Notice the almost benign language applied to Libya and Ethiopia, who were to be at his steps, that is, at the feet of the king of the north, or in subjugation to him, although not even occupied by his forces. These were also threatened severely by the Ottomans if they did not toe the mark and pay their tribute, so they did too. Now, verse 44, but tidings out of the east and out of the north, and this is in relationship to Jerusalem, not Constantinople, north of Jerusalem and east of Jerusalem, tidings shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. Well, when did this happen? Didn't happen for a long time. For 396 years, the Ottomans control over Egypt and their neighbors to the south went smoothly. Nothing much happened of importance. In 1 year, the Ottomans nearly doubled the tribute on Egypt to 720,000 pounds sterling, and the levy was willingly paid by Egypt. Even after Britain arrived in Egypt in 1882 to protect its newly acquired interest in the Suez Canal, Egypt continued to pay this tribute until the year 1917. But tidings out of the east, those 396 years are ignored in the prophecy, but now jumps directly to the next relevant events. So now we're entering section two, and we're almost caught up now. It's great. This is a little cartoon I put at the intermission. Eve asking Adam to pick up his clothes. Okay, now we're going to talk about Britain's role in Jewish statehood, continuing from this point. In the beginning years of World War I, remember now, the Ottomans have control of Palestine, as it was called. Southern was a Palestinian region of Syria, actually. In the beginning years of World War I, Turkey's Ottoman government joined with the Central Powers of Germany, Austria-Hungary, Yugoslavia, in their war against the Allies. And it was an extremely bad choice on the Ottomans' part. For nearly a century, the weakness of the Ottomans, who controlled the countries mentioned, as well as the valley of the Euphrates and Tigris rivers down to the Persian Gulf, was reflected in the appellation, the sick man of Europe. Brother Thomas speaks of the Ottomans as the sick man of Europe several times in his writings. Britain's forces in Africa were now headquartered in Cairo. This is in World War I. A new commander had just been assigned to head that force, General Edmund Allenby. Before Allenby went to Cairo, he was having dinner with the head of Scotland Yard, who happened to be a Bible student. And he said to Allenby, Lord, whoever he was, he said, I'm really not really all that anxious to be commander of the Allied forces in Egypt. I've lost nothing in Egypt. I think it's a lost cause. And that was, of course, after the defeat at at the Dardanelles, which Winston Churchill had instigated, a massive defeat of the British forces at the Dardanelles some months earlier. So he said, I'm not anxious to do that. But the head of Scotland Yard said, Allenby, don't be scared. He said, you may be a man of destiny. He said, you may fulfill prophecy because it's time for the Ottoman Empire to end and the beginning of the Jewish regathering to begin. So on that strength, Allenby took the command, and late in the year 1917, he was commanded to push northward into Palestine and Syria, in parallel with British forces, which had already entered the Euphrates Valley further east at the head of the Persian Gulf in the Shat al-Arab estuary. That's where the Tigris and Euphrates come together, and the two rivers then flow together into the Persian Gulf. That estuary is called the Shat al-Arab. So they had taken the Ottoman stronghold there of Basra near the Gulf already, and they were driving up the Euphrates Valley and the Tigris Valley. These tidings out of the east, and it's east relative to Jerusalem, as in the entirety of Daniel 11, were alarming to the Porte, who now recognized an extreme threat from that force. In addition, T.E. Lawrence, now we've got Allenby beginning to push north into Palestine. In addition, T.E. Lawrence of Arabia, was busily organizing the Bedouin of the Saudi Peninsula into an irregular Arab cavalry force mounted on camels and armed with rifles with which to harass the eastern fringes of the sparse Ottoman operations in Palestine from Aqaba to Amman. Now, this will be the territory that was neglected by the Ottomans. They don't have much of a presence there, not much of a military installation at all. So that area is east of the Jordan, and from Aqaba, way down on the Red Sea, Lawrence and his guys, if you've seen the film Lawrence of Arabia, it's pretty true to the way things actually were. It's a magnificent film by David Lean, Lawrence of Arabia. Some of these illustrations are taken from that. But they were to drive northward on the east side of Jordan through this abandoned territory of Moab, Ammon, and Edom. So Lawrence owned a much favored camel who was named Jeddah. He claimed she was beautiful. I don't think she is very beautiful. Well, camels really are beautiful, but in their own special way, and was comfortable to ride long distances. Camels always grumble and they slobber and they just stand there and they sort of look. They look like they're stupid, but they really are not stupid. And if you get too close, they will bite you. So, you know, but they're really comfortable to ride. These tidings out of the east of the British victories, were troubling to the Ottomans. So, they weren't all of the port's problems. The Germans and other allies of the Ottomans in the north were being slaughtered now in Europe and could not send reinforcements to assist him in his southeastern regions of Palestine, Syria, and Old Assyria. Together, these were the troubling tidings out of the east and north. Therefore, the Porte did what he could to allay this situation. Anticipating trouble from Allenby and Lawrence's Arabs, he vigorously moved his 7th and 8th armies into Palestine and established a strong military presence there for the first time. Before that, there were just Ottoman administrative police there because the Ottomans were so strong in that area that nobody dared resist them. So they didn't even have to put out much effort or expense to police the area, but they did have an administrative police force there. Remember that Jordan, Edom, Moab, and most of Ammon were never under tight control at all of the Ottomans. He was trying to prevent any movement of British forces into Palestine from the south. So he put these two armies into the Sharon, the coastal area of Palestine. The language of the latter portion of this verse indicates an entirely different complexion to his 1917 presence from his 1517 presence. 400 years had elapsed between these two. In contrast to his earlier passing over the land, which is almost a passive phrase, this latter stance is warlike and fierce and aggressive, which is in character with the last phrases of this verse 44. He shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, yet he shall come to his end and none shall help him. Now, that's in the Authorized Version, the King James Version. It gives us a certain impression that Turkey is going to put a military headquarters in Jerusalem. That's what it looks like. And yet he will come to his end and none shall help him. Well, what does it really mean? Well, there's a serious discrepancy in the translation of the King James Version here. If you look at the Authorized Version, I'm sorry, if you look at the Revised Standard Version, it's much different as it is in several places, and it puts an entirely different complexion on this. The King James Version, as stated here, leaves no other choice but being Jerusalem. But the Turks devoted almost no attention to Jerusalem beyond rebuilding its walls. They stationed no troops there to speak of, and their military headquarters was elsewhere when they finally established one. So what's the answer? Well, as I said, the Revised Standard Version is a translation truer to the original text and changes the picture entirely. Its rendering is, he shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountain. That's an entirely different description of what the King James Version says. The phrase palatial tents refers to his military headquarters. Moffat's translation is even more definitive in this area. His version says, pitching his royal pavilions between the Mediterranean and the sacred hill so fair. Well, that could be nothing but Jerusalem, the sacred hill so fair. So between the Mediterranean and the sacred hill so fair. So what happened? Does it fit what the Ottomans did at the time? Yes, it does. The port's forces established field headquarters for their armies at an accessible location on the coastal plain of Palestine, not at Jerusalem, in the inaccessible, mountainous, remote central highlands. Jerusalem had probably only about two roads of access, maybe three, to it, and it was hard to get to. So here's a map, and just to orient you, here's the Sea of Galilee, the source of Jordan, the Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, and there's the Dead Sea. Okay, here is Ramle. Jerusalem is right there, and this is all those escaped areas of Moab, Ammon, and Edom. That's not important right now. So they established their military headquarters at Ramle, and that's near Ben-Gurion International Airport. It's about 2 miles from where the airport is today, on the outskirts of Tel Aviv and Jaffa. And precisely between the Mediterranean and the sacred hill Sofer. This verse could have no more perfect a fulfillment. You see, the authorized version misleads us into thinking it means some kinds of structure relating to the king of the north's residence or base of authority at Jerusalem. No, he had no residence there, no base of authority except a police station, and it really refers to his military headquarters that he now established in about 1914 probably, at Ramle. That takes care of the first half of the verse. The greatest concentration of Turks and their military headquarters was on the coastal plain near Tel Aviv. So what did Allenby do? In a brilliant feint to the east, he brought people and equipment into the Jordan Valley near Jericho. Now, that's just up north of the Dead Sea, as you know, and set up dummy airfields, a huge encampment with tents, trucks, and equipment, all just mock-ups of the real thing, but good enough to deceive the few Turkish observation planes which viewed it from a distance. They photographed it. It looked like airplanes, tents, men, trucks, so forth. So they said, oh, he's going to come up the Jordan Valley. There's his advance encampment. So they started to prepare against that. The mock encampment was in the Jordan Valley here, north of the Dead Sea. Can you see? Meanwhile, Allenby moved his armies across Suez, down here, and moved up along the coast from Gaza, while the Turks had diverted much of their forces towards the east to counter the simulated British forces north of Jericho. He captured Jerusalem. He came up here and captured Jerusalem and drove them out of Ramle, removed them out of there, and northward toward Megiddo, which is here, the Valley of Jezreel. At about the same time, Lawrence, with his camel-mounted Arab irregulars, had taken Aqaba, which is down on the Red Sea, and at the top of the Red Sea, and now pushed north through the escaped territories of Edom, Moab, and Ammon, and cut the eastern branch of the Turkish railway, which ran from Afula, which is near Mount Tabor in the Galilee, to Deraa, which is down in the Saudi Peninsula. The Turkish escape route by rail was cut off. Jordan was Lawrence's battlefield in the east. This 1917 map shows the uncontrolled territories of Ammon, which is here. Amman is the same word as Ammon. It's the capital of Jordan, as you know. Edom, Moab is the middle part, and Edom is the southern part, where the Turks maintained little control over the Bedouin. The Turks faced Allenby at Megiddo in yet one more massive battle on that great, superb, level battlefield known in Greek as the Jezreel, and that lost royally to the British forces. The Turks were routed northward along the Lebanese coast into Syria and eventually back into the Anatolian Peninsula from whence they had come. Their empire in that section had dried up. Their control over the Euphrates and the Tigris had dried up. The political hegemony over it was gone. So that's what that verse means. The Turks were routed northward along the Lebanese coast into Syria. Lawrence and his Arab force arrived at Damascus before Allenby, but the victory had been decisive. On December the 9th, just before this arrival at Damascus, Allenby had arrived at Jerusalem without firing a shot and taken the city. Because the Turks, this is the Arab mentality working here, folks, listen to this. The Turks had fled the city towards the north. Why did they flee? Because they heard that somebody named Allenby, but they thought it was Allenby, was coming, and that means in Arabic, soldier of Allah. And you don't dare oppose somebody like that. So they just fled the city. So he captured without firing a shot. He entered the city, it said, walking his campaign hat over his heart, and was said to have uttered the phrase in answer to the head of Scotland Yard that he had spoken with early, "This day I have fulfilled prophecy," as he entered it. A very, very emotional moment for Allenby, I'm sure. He entered the old city through the Jaffa Gate at the Tower of David, where he accepted the surrender of the Turkish garrison. Here they are surrendering. As a result of these British actions, the power which had controlled the Euphrates Valley for these hundreds of years had been forced back inside its lair. The Ottomans had returned to Turkey, never again to overflow their borders. Their power had been dried up by the British victories in the eastern provinces, and the way had been opened for establishment of the fig tree and all the trees of Jesus' prophecy, as in Luke 21:29. That's the only place where Jesus is recorded as saying, "Behold, the budding of the fig tree and all the trees." What does he mean by that? Okay, we'll talk about that in a second. These in another figure were the kings of the east of Revelation 12. The new nations, which soon filled the Ottoman territory left vacant by Britain's victory. A king headed nearly every new Arab principality. Now, I think there's a total of about 22 of them when you consider the Emirates and the Arab states of the Gulf and Kuwait and all those. I think there's 22 of them. All of them sprung up at this time. So when the fig tree was blossoming, so were these other trees. And these were the kings of the east. These sprung up where the Ottomans had been removed. Those which weren't headed by kings were headed by sheikhs or emirs, which are essentially the same thing, despotic rulers. However, the British conquerors of what was then called Palestine could not be called the king of the south. Now, why do we say that? Because the prophecy ends with the last end of the king of the north, and there's no more anybody called king of the south. Because Britain did not take this action because it wanted the land of Palestine for its own possessions, but it was in a real sense conquering it for a homeland for the Jewish people of the world. That's what the Balfour Declaration, which fortunately was issued only 5 weeks before Allenby took Jerusalem, the Balfour Declaration said, we will administer this land for the formation of a Jewish state. And we'll see a picture of that document in a minute. So they were taking it not for their own imperial interest, but for the Jewish people, ostensibly, on the surface. It was a fact proven by the previously issued Balfour Declaration, which was a legal document designating the purpose for which Britain was to take Palestine by physical conquest. So here's the legal and the physical aspects of it both covered. Even though that may not have been in the mind of every British officer who fought for Palestine, that was God's destined purpose for the land, and this was the first tangible step toward the resumption of the fulfillment of his eternal purpose in the land and for his people. Therefore, Britain is not called and is not identified as the King of the South, as some have said. After the last King of the North manifests himself and defeats the Egyptian King of the South, 1517, there is no more reference to any King of the South. Instead, the dispersion of Israel was about to start drawing to its conclusion. The diaspora would now diminish, and the population within the land would steadily gain, and at times spurt forward quite rapidly. Only 5 weeks, as I said before, this Balfour Declaration had proclaimed Britain's favor toward Palestine as a homeland for the Jewish people. Here's the actual Balfour declaration of November 2nd, 1917. This was 5 weeks before December the 9th when Allenby took it. So the stage had been set for a legal acquisition of the land, and then Allenby exercised his prerogative and took physical control of it. Later, Britain reneged, and very, very soon, but that did not change either the symbolism of their original act or the purpose of the Almighty. Thus ended the momentous prophecy of the times of the Gentiles, a name given the period by the Lord Jesus Christ himself in Luke 21:24, as he stood mourning Jerusalem on Olivet's eastern slopes, that's a typo, that evening in 29 A.D., only hours prior to his personal sacrifice. No, it is the western slope, sorry. Just a minor point. That evening in A.D. 29, only hours prior to his personal sacrifice on the tree at Golgotha. The scene before him was this. was dominated by the incomparable Herod's temple, this is a model of Herod's temple, yet standing starkly upon its spacious platform, yet to be the center of Jewish ritual for only another 40 years, then to be destroyed. Jerusalem Day looks like this from the Mount of Olives. Sorry, that's a little blurry. As you know, the period had its beginning in 604 BC when Israel was overthrown by Babylon. The first temple was overthrown and destroyed in 587 BC. It ran through seven periods of 360 years each, 7 years of years until 1917 when the 2520 years expired and the captivity of Israel began to be reversed. The period had experienced an abrupt beginning in 604 BC after years of preparation. Its end came likewise in one day, beginning several years of the transition to Jewish sovereignty over Jerusalem through a period of much tribulation with their neighbors. Israel, in 1948, even though it was established as the owner of Jerusalem, it still didn't own the old city for 19 more years. And that's really important and significant that it took 19 more years, because we'll come to that in a while. Balfour's stated purpose was betrayed by Britain's mandatory government, which quickly decided it would not be in Britain's best interest to establish a Jewish state there. The conversion of its naval forces, Britain's naval forces, from coal to oil made Arab petroleum an absolute necessity for Britain, who could not afford to offend the Arabs. God's plan was immutably destined to be otherwise, however, and he brought it to a successful conclusion, never to be reversed by any man or nation. Now, a word to the prudent and wise. With this perfect fulfillment of the last end of the King of the North, please, please, please put him out of your prophetic conscience, except as a reminiscence, as an artifact, and as concrete proof that our Almighty Father conspicuously and accurately and perfectly fulfills prophecy before our eyes with absolute perfection, but that he also expects us to exercise our intellect and recognize it and acknowledge it and be thankful for it. Otherwise, your expectations will be muddy and unclearly focused. Do not confuse the King of the North with another king from the uttermost parts of the North who is also destined to come upon the mountains of Israel. This terminology may have been put in the scriptures, the similarity of these two, King of the North, and from the uttermost parts of the North, just to exercise our intellects and see, can you figure this out? Or are you too dumb to do it? He's also destined to come upon the mountains of Israel, the host of Gog, of the land of Magog, from the uttermost parts of the North, chief prince of Meshach and Tubal, as foretold in Ezekiel 38 and 39. As we've seen, all the parameters of this still future event are unique to it alone. It's not even similar to the King of the North, the Ottoman Empire, which had come to an end. We aren't there yet in historic time. We have some space to go. But the termination of the King of the North has rolled over into the prophetic literature, from the prophetic literature into that of history, and we should fully and readily recognize that. Now, while we're on this subject of identifying God's and Israel's vile enemies, we need to take some time to summarize the many differences between the King of the North, the Ottomans, and Gog, often confused with each other. With the foregoing facts in our minds, it's an easy, definitive difference, and is patently, I think, conclusive. So just what differences are seen in the accounts of the Gogian invasion and that of the King of the North? And we sometimes abbreviate that as K of N. We now list several striking, acute differences, and many others may be found with further study, I don't know. The two accounts are found in Daniel 11, 40 through 45, the King of the North, and Ezekiel 38 and 39, Gog. One, the states named as combatants are consistently different for the two conflicts. Neither conflict's account has any state listed in common with the other, except the state of Israel, whom they all attack. There's an exception to that, however, Egypt and Ethiopia, but in the case of the King of the North, they're at his feet, and in the case of Gog, they are with him as a confederate. So their status, the status of Ethiopia and Libya, Cush, Libya and Ethiopia, Cush, are exactly opposite in the two cases. Gog is destroyed. Number two, as soon as he approaches Israel, Ezekiel 38:18, the king of the north is not destroyed, but merely comes to his end after a long period of occupation of the entire land with none to help, Daniel 11:45. That latter named aggressor was largely driven from the land, not slain on the mountains of Israel, although many were. Three, the Ottoman does not sweep through the land and passes over it, the king of the north. But Daniel does not suggest that he is destroyed in Bashan or east of the sea or even destroyed at all. Many of the Ottomans were killed, king of the north, but the remainder was driven back into Anatolia where their empire ceased and disappeared, having been replaced by the modern government of Turkey under Gemal Ataturk. Four, Gog cannot take the treasures of Egypt, for not only does he never reach Egypt, but there are no treasures in Egypt to take anymore. Egypt is always on the verge of bankruptcy, and the only treasures it has are those old relics from the pyramids and the tombs of the kings. It has no liquid capital to speak of, whereas during the time of the king of the north it did. It was a rich country. The king of the north, the Euphratean power, of Revelation 16:12, of the Ottomans, or Turkey, did take them away and collected tribute of Egypt for 400 years. Five, Gog in Ezekiel 38:39 is not described as taking control of modern Israel, nor even of causing any perceptible harm to it. Ezekiel assures us Gog is destroyed as soon as he comes against the land of Israel. The Ottoman Turk, as the king of the north, on the other hand, overran all of Palestine, its provincial name at the time, and held it under its thumb for 400 years. Six, Gog cannot take Jerusalem because Ezekiel does not describe him as even entering modern Israel as we know it today. He only gets as far as the area east of the Sea of Galilee or the Dead Sea and the Jordan Valley. The king of the north, however, not only overran the entire Holy Land in pursuit of the Egyptians in 1517, but he established a minor military garrison there to guard his interests. Gog does not destroy two-thirds of the returned Jews, as many claim. No such hint is found in Ezekiel 38 and 39. They bring to prove that Zechariah 13, which many erroneously link with this account in Ezekiel. That's what I was speaking about yesterday, about bringing all these extraneous references in and saying, oh, that refers to this. But no, it doesn't refer to it at all in the first century overthrow of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. Indeed, it's the practically undisturbed Jews of Ezekiel 38, 9, and 12, the house of Israel, who the scripture says, go forth out of the cities of Israel to bury Gog. They're not even affected by the Gogian onslaught at all. They may have a little trepidation, but the Lord Jesus Christ, who is there when Gog comes down, assures them, don't worry, my people, we'll take care of it. Don't worry. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. As a matter of interest, there were but few Jews in the land when the Ottoman Turk overflowed and passed over the land on his way to Egypt in 1517. An additional fact of great importance is that the Egyptians were his enemies when he entered the land and passed over it, not the Jews. He had not come to Israel to take a spoil and a prey. He was chasing the Egyptians back to Cairo so he could take control over their country. And still another important fact, no purges of the Jews that we know of were instituted at any time during Ottoman occupation of the land. Eight, Gog never takes Egypt either, nor Libya, nor Ethiopia, or Cush, because in his drive south he gets no further than the Bashan, where he is totally destroyed. The king of the north, however, took complete control over Palestine and Egypt and exercised pervasive hegemony over Libya and Ethiopia, taking tribute of all each year from all the last three. Libya and Ethiopia are the only countries named in both campaigns, but it is patently apparent that the involvement of these two are entirely opposite in the two accounts, showing clearly that they are both participants in one invasion, that of Gog, but they are merely victims of the king of the north in Daniel 11. Nine, Gog will not attempt to attack Israel until Israel dwells safely and has great wealth, which as we shall see, as we see it, will not truly appear until apply until Christ comes. The Ottoman king of the north overran the glorious land, but did not take the land for its wealth. It had none. It was not sufficiently significantly cultivated or built up. It almost had almost no known natural resources except the minerals of the Dead Sea, vast riches which at that time were unrealized. At the time of the Ottoman invasion of the land in 1517, there was no Israel. It cannot be described at that time as having been Jewish in composition, although a few Jews lived there and a few Arabs. It had no wealth at all. The land was sparsely settled, was defined only by the name Palestine, the southernmost province of the region known as Syria, which was then under the control of Egypt, the king of the south of that day. The Ottoman, however, harvested the vast wealth of Egypt for 400 years, all of which he hauled away to Constantinople. Even some of the richest families in Egypt he compelled to move to Constantinople and bring their wealth with them. 10. Gog is described in Ezekiel 38:5-7 as being a guard to many nations. No such description is given by Daniel, the king of the north. The Ottoman north king supplied little to anyone, but took everything he could get from everyone. 11. Gog is nowhere described in Ezekiel 38:39 as planting a tabernacle in the glorious holy mountain or anywhere else. Rather, God rains on him and his associated people rain, hail, fire, brimstone as soon as he comes against Israel. He has no time to plant much of anything anywhere before he is utterly destroyed. The king of the north, meanwhile, is described by Daniel as having planted the tabernacle of his palace between the seas in the glorious holy mountain, or that alternate translation of the RSV. The tabernacle is actually his military pavilion or headquarters, which the Ottoman Turk did establish there at Ramleh. Number 12, the Gogian host comes against Israel, my people, to take a spoil and to take a prey. The king of the north could not come against Israel, my people, because there was no Israel, my people, in the land. And he had no objective in Palestine at all. It was merely a highway to get to Cairo. And certainly none in Israel, because it would not even exist for 430 years into the future from 1517. He was interested in the treasures of Egypt, two entirely different countries, two entirely different objectives. 13. The Gogian host is said to invade a land containing a remnant of God's people brought back from the sword and gathered out of many people against the mountains of a nation called Israel and a people dwelling safely, a condition that even now cannot be said to exist. Even today, armed to the teeth as they are, they dwell not in safety, and they realize that, and never have dwelt in safety since the state was founded. Nor was this condition even remotely true in 1517 when the Ottoman king of the north overran Palestine and there was not yet a nation named Israel. It wouldn't be for hundreds of years, and only a few Jews dwelt there in that arid, malaria-ridden, forgotten backwater that was the Syrian province of Palestine. So the summary of all this is that the foregoing notes compare the activities and intentions of the king of the north with the Gogian phase two battle of the end time. However, we must also admit there is as much difference between the final conflict of the phase one campaign, which we're in right now, and the Gogian, the phase two campaign, yet two future showdowns of the land and people of Israel, as are clearly demonstrated between the two just compared. So the prophecy of the demise of the Gogian host shall likewise roll over into history, into perfect fulfillment of God's holy oracles, but not yet, not for some time yet, perhaps a few years. And I say that qualifiedly because we don't really know how long it'll be, because we don't know how long the events that have to precede it will take to accomplish. We obviously have first to deal with closer, more proximal enemies of Israel. At the end of the transitional period, which began in 1917, in almost precisely 30 years, see Daniel 12:11, the United Nations organization voted to partition Palestine, giving a portion of it to the Jews and a portion of it to the Arabs. The State of Israel was formed 30 years after the Balfour Declaration. The event occurred on May 14 when the Palestine Post, later to become the Jerusalem Post, ran this banner headline. Believers have been expecting the imminent appearance of Christ on the earth for decades, especially since 1948. I've lived with bated breath thinking it's going to be in just months, but it hasn't been, and it hasn't been, and it hasn't been, and it still hasn't been, and it still hasn't been, but it will be. From that milestone, Israel's journey has not been easy. we have evidently mistaken. pardon me. A well-known passage in Micah 7:15. We've often talked about this. According to the days of thy coming out of Egypt, will I show unto him marvelous things. That is, after Israel was established, we thought it was going to be 40 years, because that's how long it took to come out of Egypt. We mistakenly had calculated that the return of Christ would occur within 40 years, the length of Israel's testing in the wilderness. But the emphasis was not to be on those number of days, as we supposed, a period of 40 years matching their wilderness journey, but it is instead to be on the series of miraculous events which befell Israel. It was to be the character of this early establishment of Israel that was similar to the Exodus, and not the time of it, the length of its fulfillment. The miraculous events which befell Israel during the subsequent years of the state, in which God's glorious hand of delivery was clearly discernible. Daniel 12:1-3 says, "I'm going to put Michael the archangel in charge of Israel when I bring about this their resurrection from the nations." And that's what those three verses are referring to, although it does eventuate in the actual resurrection of the dead. But one is a foreshadowing of the other. But the series of miraculous events which befell Israel during the first years of the state, God's glorious hand of delivery was clearly discernible. It's Michael the archangel, folks, in the background, guiding the affairs of Israel, protecting them, driving them forward, causing them to get more and more wealthy, and protect them from their enemies. The emphasis then was on the marvelous things of their journey and not its length. We beheld these in great abundance, the major miracles being the survival of the state in the first place, when 660,000 Jews had to fight over 40 million Arabs and did so successfully. We observed similar military prowess during the next three wars in 1956, 1967, and 1973 in subsequent actions in which Israel was forced to defend itself or perish and came out remarkably quickly on top. The Israelis had warned Jordan to remain neutral during this conflict of 1967, but was drawn into the war by President Nasser's blatant lies about Egyptian victories. The king of Jordan figured, well, I better get in on this or I'm going to be left in the dust because he's winning all these battles. Well, he wasn't. He was simply lying. And Israel was listening to his telephone conversations while Nasser was talking to him. And fortunately didn't say, no, Nasser, you're lying. No, that would have changed the course of history. After 19 years under Jordanian control, the Old City and East Jerusalem was taken by Israeli forces, and the Old City united under united Israeli control for the first time in 2,300 years. That's a key point. This action was completed on June 7th, 1967, and that specific day ended the prophecy of the sanctuary cycle of Daniel 8:14, precisely on time, 2,300 Gentile years after it had initiated in the year 334 B.C., when Alexander the Great had beaten the forces of the Persian army in the Battle of the River Granicus in Asia Minor. We recall the Six-Day War of 1967. I remember hearing the radio reports that we have entered the Old City. Israeli Army Radio broadcast to the world, we have entered the Old City. And then minutes later, we have taken the Western Wall. Here are soldiers at the Western Wall in that 1967 war. When that ended in 6 days, six miraculous days, the new borders of Israel looked like this. Which before it had been just this little part here. But now they had all the Sinai, they had all the West Bank, so-called. That's an Arab term, so I don't like to use it. They had the Golan, they had the Old City, they had control over everything. Today their tribulations of the end time are nearing their end, but the end is not quite yet. Perhaps for the sole reason that the fullness of the Gentiles has not come in. The predetermined number of Gentiles have not yet been taught the principles of the gospel. I'm ambivalent on that point, and maybe you are too, but maybe that is the thing that's holding back the final fulfillment of this end of phase one, which will be the time of the coming of Christ and the clearing of the land of all the squatters that are there now. Since 1948, the Islamic states on the borders and near Israel have fought her very existence. They remain enraged that a prosperous Israel exists in a sea of Islamic poverty and ruin. Brother Roboto showed the remarkable difference of the brownness of the Palestinian versus the greenness of Israel. They say that as one man, in the only unity that the Arabs can manage, let us take to ourselves the houses of God in possession, very perfectly foretold in Psalm 83:12. Israel's, as well as their enemies' certain assurance, is found in Psalm 83:14. And listen to this. How more definite can you get as to the condemnation of their activities? As the fire burneth the wood, and as the flame setteth the mountains on fire, so persecute them with thy tempest, and make them afraid with thy storm. This Psalm 83 is set in the context of a prayer of Asaph, but it's a very concrete prophecy. Fill their faces with shame. Let them be confounded and troubled forever. Yea, let them be put to shame and perish, their existence completely ended, that men may know that thou, whose name alone is Jehovah, art the Most High over all the earth. These fierce enemies are now building their accounts of guilt before God for their murderous treatment of his people. Their defeat shall be exhaustive and complete and final. Ezekiel 35, in addition to Obadiah, is a clear summary account of the utter destruction of Edom, Mount Seir, and the reasons for it. After that victory, says the prophet, shall Israel know me? Shall Israel know me? A landmark development indeed, because they don't know him quite yet today. We'll remark on 6 or 7 examples of the time of Israel's recognition of him later, and we will have time for that. Meanwhile, what does this statement mean? When shall Israel know that I am the Lord? All right, we're going to stop there, and because that's a new subject, and we'll start there tomorrow. Thank you.